Welcome to this special episode of Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. I'm Erdem Koch, and today we kick off the first of a four-part series looking into the Express Pearl disaster. In May 2021, just off the coast of Sri Lanka, a cargo ship carrying hazardous chemicals caught fire and sank in what was a serious maritime incident that impacted on coastal communities and the environment. But it didn't have to happen, because multiple failures stacked on top of each other turned a dangerous situation into a national catastrophe. Today, we're introducing that story: the ship, the leak, the fire, and the cascade of decisions and non-decisions that led to one of the most avoidable environmental disasters in recent memory. And over the coming weeks, we'll go deeper. We'll break down the environmental impact with an assessment of what really ended up in the water and on Sri Lanka's beaches. We'll analyse the economic fallout from lost fisheries to the billion-dollar compensation battle that's still playing out. And we'll unpack the legal process, the accountability fight, and what this case is now setting as precedent. My co-hosts, as always, are Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim. Gents, good to be with you both.
Good to be with you.
Good to talk, as always.
Rodney, we're going to unpack so many elements of this story in this special four-part series of Put Simply, but let's just take a step back for a second and ask you to provide some background. Starting with the political landscape of Sri Lanka, what's happened in recent years and how does that set the scene for the story itself?
Well, Erdem, we always cover politics. We love covering elections. And obviously Sri Lanka had a very dramatic election last year. They had a party move into power that went from three seats in parliament to 159. And then also took the presidency. So that's 159 of 225 seats from virtually, I'm going to say, nowhere or no experience of government. So there's always going to be an issue with these new governments in terms of experience, but there's other political parties that are in government. But there's also this thought process around how do populists actually govern? Can you win elections? Yes. Can you deliver good government? And there's always going to be a question mark around that. And in Sri Lanka, the current governing party who won the election pitched their campaign around anti-corruption, good governments, positioning the country on a more social welfare platform and end to family political dynasties in the country. And they were then going to deliver this agenda all in the shadow of IMF management and a bailout. And so what really, you know, struck my mind at the start was, well, let's go through some of their key election pledges. And there's, you know, they did have an anti-corruption drive, but there's a question mark now that sits around whether some of those proceedings are politically motivated, a little bit like people are questioning who Trump's pursuing in America and so on. So key election pledge potentially delivered. In terms of economic policy, it's largely been a U-turn, they would say, down to the rule of the IMF, and they've been in line with many of the guardrails put in place by the IMF, and they promised to challenge some of those IMF-led positions, but have not done so or not done so yet. In terms of health, they promised a level of investment, which they've not been able to deliver, in particular around medicine poverty. Education investment hasn't been delivered either. Despite their supermajority, they haven't delivered the electoral and constitutional reform that they promised. They've U-turned on another election pledge in relation to a body that was to be set up and agreed with the Indian authorities. Again, they ruled that out, but are now starting to have discussions in relation to that. And similarly with the decentralization of the energy sector and a shift to renewables, that's starting to backslide as well. There has been some discussions on debt renegotiation, but again, without particular outcomes. All interesting points, all things that, you know, perhaps over a longer mandate that they'll be able to achieve. But one other thing that came out when they first won the election last year is they promised to look again at this shipping incident from 2021 involving the Express Pearl. And they presented it as part of the anti-corruption issue, the competence of the previous government. And again, that was sort of fitted with their narrative. And it really sort of came to a head in July of this year when there was a large compensation ruling by the Supreme Court in Sri Lanka of 1 billion of a possible $6 billion. Quite astronomical figures, even in the context of an environmental incident like this. And it caused some eyebrows to be raised, not least within the broader shipping community, because there's implications for trade, the use of Colombo as a transshipment hub, the competition from India to move business away from Colombo in Sri Lanka, and other sort of broader factors, as well as, the insurance of ships and so on, where you can have these types of proceedings. And the proceedings weren't initially supposed to be in Sri Lanka, but under the new government, things accelerated towards this point of decision last year. So anyway, it made me dig a little bit more into whether they'd properly looked at this issue again. This issue obviously affects some of the communities who had voted for the government in large numbers, and whether they were really delivering change for those people and delivering the transparency and economic reform and accountability that they had sort of promised. And there were local government elections in the early part of this year, and already the shine is starting to feel like it's coming off the government. Not a huge amount of polling data in Sri Lanka to track this, but the shine looked as if it was coming off. They still won the majority of seats in the majority of councils, but not in the same number as they had success in the autumn of last year. And also more of a geographical mismatch, more urban, more Sinhalese areas, less success in some of the Tamil areas that they'd done quite well in the broader election. So that's sort of why we arrived at the point of discussing this particular incident. And then, of course, when you dig into it, I find many really interesting points that really didn't form part of what the first blush read of it produced. But yeah, I mean, that's the political context. Ozan, I suppose these types of issues and are those that are affecting all populist governments when they get into power, having to try and deliver an agenda which perhaps they never expected that they'd have to.
Yes, Rodney, I think you've hit on some very good points. I think we've seen very much a case study in the Sri Lankan situation where, President Dissanayake campaigned on some very populist topics and populist initiatives. On the corruption, I thought it was pretty interesting that many critics are talking about some of the cases that the administration has actually picked on or decided to take up being very much politically motivated. There's a sense of a lack of kind of systemic change or an effort to bring about institutional change, which is what I believe was really the intention at the start. They seem to be in a tough place, and I think they I think it, and it sets a very nice kind of backdrop for the kind of deep dive we're about to make into this fascinating story.
Yeah, absolutely, Ozan. And there's another procurement issue around vehicles, which is becoming a bit of a scandal for the current government. Obviously, in the past few days, Sri Lanka's had a terrible series of floods as a result of the cyclone, death tolls in the hundreds. But already, even with the local media, still so early into that incident, there's some reporting which is questioning the experience of the government and being able to handle a very challenging situation. And it was the same sort of thing which plagued previous or a previous government during this incident in 2021, where the port authorities and so on come in for some criticism. I mean, if we look at where the shipping incident really started with the Express Pearl and what followed, it was a container ship, fairly new one, looted in the UAE and Jebel Ali. Containers are put on board with these transshipment vessels, and my understanding is it's a little bit like bus stops, where you go from stop to stop and unload and load rather than passengers' containers. And this exercise, a little bit like the post, doesn't involve you necessarily checking the contents of every envelope, but having a system in place to, that people who are approved pack these things and then approve them, and then they get loaded onto your vessel and so on. And this particular incident and the story behind it really starts with a container that was loaded in Jebel Ali in the UAE that wasn't well packed, and that was later to be a finding of an independent investigation that took place actually under the Singapore Transport Investigations Bureau. It contained nitric acid, and because it was poorly packed, it was leaking. And shortly after the vessel or the ship, the Express Pearl, left Jebel Ali, it was noticed by the crew that one of the containers was found to be leaking. And they obviously put into place their response plan. Some of these things involve watering down containers that might be leaking with chemicals to ensure that it has a level of dilution and maybe doesn't start to erode aspects of the ship or something like that. But these sort of things get in play, and then you put in a call to the first port that you're going to, and you ask whether or not you can offload something which is presenting a danger or a risk. And that's exactly what they did. And they, within a day or two, they arrived in Qatar at Hamad Port. They made the request. It looked like that was going to be fine. And then later on, the Qataris said they wouldn't be able to offload this container. And remarkable as it sounds, you're just sent back out to sea again, Ozan. You're dispatched to your next port. What you have to do then is call on to the next port, which in this case was Hazira in India, and again make the same request. I mean, it's a remarkable set of circumstances that these ports, if you have something which is presenting a risk because it's been poorly packed, because it contains chemicals, that no one has to help you. I mean, it's quite a remarkable attitude to these things, that this is what in fact happens. And if you're a vessel, you can request and you can ask, but you've got no guarantees of help. So it's sent off to Hazira again, a period of time at sea. You make the same request, and again, after some positive noises, it's a no, for reasons that they don't have anywhere to put this container, or we don't have the right equipment to handle it. Again, remarkable if you're a port dealing in this type of business that you wouldn't have the capacity to deal with something that was leaking. Dispatched then across the sea to Colombo, and I think there was a cyclone at the time, name escapes me, but it involved the ship then moving around the cyclone, which involved a lot of disruption at sea and hazardous sea conditions. They arrive in Colombo, where again the same request is made. I think it arrived in Colombo late in an evening in May, and request is made, explanation given that this problem exists. I think the original berthing point was 5 days later. Again, this is a proper window on this type of business, Suzanne, when you can arrive somewhere, and as we can see often, in the straits here off Singapore, you see lots of ships waiting to go into port to either pick up or deposit or whatever they happen to do. So obviously the same type of thing applies off Colombo. So it's sort of waiting, guys, we have a difficulty, can we offload this? Let's remove risk from the picture. And again, nothing. Not a yes, not a no. Smoke starts to come out of the ship in Colombo. And remember, this journey's been over 10 days by now, different various points of request for help, and then arriving in Sri Lanka. smoke starts to
Before
arrive.
perhaps you go into the smoke starting, what I found fascinating, and maybe you can clear this up for me, but the shipping operator wasn't actually notified of the leaking container until they had set sail. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something which was disclosed to them. It was put on the vessel and they noticed it en route.
And that's again a massive,
Huge
I
opportunity.
guess,
Absolutely.
like massive issue or massive kind of loophole in the whole regulations. Like there must be some safety protocol in place that says, "Hey, I'm packing you a container that's effectively leaking some really nasty stuff. You need to deal with this, or they should have just dealt with it at the port." Is that have I understood the whole scenario correctly?
So there was actually more than one container from the same source. One was found to be leaking and not put on the ship. Another one of the same batch, packed by the same people, was put on. One would have thought that the Port Authority at that point would have questioned, well, if that one's not right, perhaps we should be a little bit more careful with the other one. Really good point, Ozan. And again, these things simply didn't happen. And if we look at, opportunities that were there to avoid this problem, that's probably the first in time, followed by then the refusal in Qatar and the refusal in India. And then we get to what happened, in Colombo, where there's also a further refusal. So in a sense, maybe the Sri Lankan authorities aren't being singled out for the refusal, but what happens after that in terms of the environmental impact and so on happens on their shores. So their decision making and the decision making by the authorities there had a direct impact on their country, on their people and on their own communities. And therefore, what decision making did they take? What did they not take? And what's the impact? I guess the thing which always sticks to my mind was if an airplane flying around developed some technical issue and airports decided that they weren't going to let it land. That's for me as a non-maritime person, the obvious parallel. And from the public's view, it would be inconceivable that someone would refuse to assist, because in refusing to assist, you're increasing the risk of something very bad happening.
And I guess we'll get into this a bit deeper when we look at some of the regulatory sides of it. But I suspect the laws of international aviation are probably much tighter on this stuff. And in fact, the outcome or the potential outcome, the stakes are obviously incredibly significant with people dying on a plane if something was to go wrong and an airport was to deny them access to a landing strip or whatever. But it's not to downplay what the catastrophic kind of outcome of this spill and this incident, but it could have been worse. You shouldn't have a set of very strict and stringent and let's be honest, I had a look at in preparation for our discussion some of those regulations around the actual obligations of ports to treat or to help calls for help and distress vessels, etc. And they're very grey, but I suspect the aviation ones would be pretty black and white.
100%. I think there's clearly a gap on a I say this as a non-maritime lawyer, but with some understanding of legal principles and so on, that there's not some duty to assist in the same way I understand that there is if there's a risk to life, a direct risk to life at sea, vessels and ports would be obliged to assist. They're not if the risk is indirect and presented through hazardous cargo and so on. And part of it is they probably don't want to invite the risk closer to home. And there was an incident, I think last week or 10 days ago in LA, where there was a similar leaking container on a large vessel that was actually in the port in LA. And what they had was the most remarkable, quick, coordinated, decisive response, where they contained the fire, they shut down the port, they weren't worried about the commercial implications because it was an issue of safety, human, environmental. Once they managed the risk in the immediacy, and it involved the fire service, the ports authority, multiple agencies immediately acting within an hour of the incident being reported under a unified command. And then they moved the vessel slightly out of the port in order to put an exclusion zone around it. They cooled it down over a number of days. They brought it back in and they unloaded a leaking container, which was or hazardous containers, I should say. There was an electrical fire close to, which presented, a risk to, various types of, chemicals and other things. The speed and decisiveness of the response was pretty remarkable, and it's not something you always expect with emergency responses in the US. But the contrast between this US incident 2 weeks ago and what happened in Sri Lanka and Colombo 4 years ago is day and night. The contrast could not be greater. When it arrived, it was at some point in the afternoon. I think it was around 2 o'clock or after lunch. I read one of these investigation reports, which is why I'm able to have a little bit of detail around this. There was smoke coming from this area where the leaking container was. Again, there was a request from the ship to bring on board port officials to assess the incident, which they duly did about an hour and a half later. They spent a couple of hours on the vessel, didn't deem it an immediate emergency or a pressing issue, and they said that they would go back to shore and discuss. So fire officials and a naval officer in Colombo on the ship at 3 o'clock or whatever, half three, had a proper investigation over a couple of hours, and then they got back on their ship and said, "Keep us informed. We're going to go and discuss. We're going to get into a bit of a huddle on this." Later on, an hour and a half, 2 hours later, an hour and a half, I believe it was, the report says that the captain again contacts the port authorities and says, "What's happening?" Nothing. Again, 10 or 15 minutes after that, again, chasing up on it, no decision, nothing. And within 3 hours, flames and an explosion had happened on the ship as a result of just rising and rising and rising temperatures. So I look at what happened in the US and then I look at what happened in Colombo, and it just felt like that there wasn't that sense of urgency, that ability to coordinate resources to respond to an incident effectively. And yet this is a major shipping hub. Colombo's not some, small port. This is handling a lot of business in the region. And you would expect it to have the capacity to deal with serious incidents. I mean, is that wrong, Uzan? Am I slightly overly expecting the ability of people who service ships to be able to deal with emergency situations?
I'm equally fascinated by this because I think we're very quick, and I've been guilty of this at times, to jump to conclusions and put the blame on certain parties when, such such environmental kind of incidents happen. But when you dig deeper into it, you do see that there is a serious failure of governance. I think driven by not just the lack of kind of clear regulations and the grey nature of those kind of rules that are in place, but also what was taking place from the human part of it, and human actions really, need to be questioned around how this was allowed to happen. Of course, a large part has to do with a serious oversight by loading this leaking container on, and then being refused help and entry into ports as there was calls for help. And then when you do, and things start to reach a certain level where you're like, okay, now things are getting serious, we're seeing smoke. It's absolutely fascinating and somewhat concerning that there's such a lack of urgency and lack of action. And Adam, I feel like Rodney and I have monopolized and pretty much having a conversation as we would do when we're sitting at the pub here. But why don't you come in?
No, that's okay, gents. But it is fascinating in the sense that I wonder how much of this, and we'll probably get to this in later episodes, is a bit of a difference in approach due to the perception of the maritime industry versus the air industry, right? Because To your point earlier about, why there are different standards here. I mean, we all use airplanes. We jump on and off planes all the time, or most people do anyway. We see airplanes above us. Airports are usually things we drive past or are relatively close to the places that we live. It's not the same for shipping ports, right? And for cargoes, although we rely on that network and that industry so much. And we saw during COVID or the disaster in the Suez Canal of how much impact that can have when even a single shipping container either malfunctions or, in this case, has a serious issue contained with it. I wonder from a regulatory perspective whether the care or the same diligence isn't applied because of the perception of these particular industries. And we can probably get into that a little bit, further down the track as we continue to deep dive here. But just to finish off this week's episode, Rodney, talk us through, and you did a little bit, but what was the actual coastal impact on Sri Lanka's beaches and on the environment in large to wrap up this particular week?
When you look at what the Singapore Transport Ministry or Transport Investigations Bureau said in their independent investigation, they said that the response by the Colombo authorities was at best limited. And they had sent out firefighting tug initially a few hours later after the explosion, which didn't have the capacity to put water on the part of the ship that was on fire because of some incompatibility of hoses or limited reach. And then even though they provided other firefighting tugs during the course of the incident, the Singapore authorities again said it was intermittent. And at some points, and again, this sort of blows my brain that this was a decision that someone would have taken. They took the firefighting tugs away to do other duties during the fire. They took them off to tow other boats around, despite there being a fire on a large vessel containing chemicals and plastics, which of course becomes the hub or the nub of the environmental impact. And even when it became clear that there was, there was serious risk, and again, the independent Singapore investigation set this out very clearly. The operator or the shipping company or whatever, they asked, could they tow the ship further away to reduce the risk should it be lost, or should this become a large scale incident? And the Sri Lankans didn't respond for 48 hours. And by the time they responded, the crew had evacuated because of the risk to the individuals involved. And this is, again, after a number of days of them supporting the firefighting efforts on board. And it was towed then into a tail end of the cyclone, which had disrupted the route in the first place. And in doing so, the tow rope broke, maneuvered the ship back towards the shore. So exactly what was trying not to be done, and positioned it in a way that the wind accelerated, or the storm accelerated the fire. And this all happened again as a result of delay. And what, we were talking about a large number of containers. There was something like 1,400 containers that were lost then. Some were incinerated in the fire. No one's quite sure what proportion were incinerated and what were lost at sea, or at least they say no one knew, or that I've been able to ascertain or read. But then there's a large loss of other cargo, which some of which then is recovered, but some of which washes up on beaches in Sri Lanka, and some of which involves these things called plastic nurdles, which are small plastic compounds that are used to manufacture other plastic items. So this isn't an oil spill incident, as many of what we would look at as historic shipping or pollution events are. This is one that involves plastics. So what we will come on to look at in further episodes then is, what that is, and and how that interacted with marine life, and what the consequences were for beaches and aquatic animals, and how effective cleanup operations can be, because these are very small items. And those are all sort of, I'm going to say, other steps in the story when we come on to discuss what happened over the months afterwards. But when you look at this from a first blush and you realize it didn't have to happen, and there were a number of opportunities for it not to happen, it's a pretty remarkable start to our deep dive into what was a significant incident for Colombo and for Sri Lanka.
Indeed, and a great way to introduce this particular story as we continue to deep dive over the coming episodes. Gents, wonderful to kickstart this special series of Put Simply with you both. See you on the next episode.